The Laura Murphy Show, episode 36.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. This is episode 36. Now, this is actually episode 2 of 3 on this series of tax reform and international trade. So in episode 35, for those of you who missed it, I laid out this series. So what's happening is in the previous episode and this current one, it's actually the Murphy Show, insofar as Carlos is not going to be joining me, because what's happening is I'm reviewing a lot of standard results in the economics literature, and it seems superfluous to have Carlos there and say, yep, gotcha, Bob. Okay, what next? And so I'm just deciding to go ahead and do these two episodes. So that was episode 35, and on this one, 36, by myself. And then in 37, which is going to be part 3 of this series, Carlos will be back in the saddle with me, or I guess we have 2 separate saddles. Otherwise, that would get crowded. And we'll talk about the GOP plan, but just more generally about tax reform and how does theory interact with the real world? Because as we'll see, there have been episodes in the past that there was tax reform that made perfect sense according to the theory, but then ended up having pretty drastic economic consequences. And Carlos has some personal experience with that. Okay, so to review, last time in episode 35, I went over this border tax adjustment stuff and reviewed some results. I walked through a Scott Sumner post over at EconLog because I thought that was the single best one to warm people up to understand this pretty complex analysis of the border tax adjustment plan that the GOP has proposed. And so now in this episode, which we're now listening to, episode 36 here, I'm going to just give the standard mainstream economist position on many aspects of tax reform. So as you guys know, who are longtime listeners, Carlos and I are big fans of the Austrian school of economics, and we're also politically very libertarian. So what I'm saying in this podcast is consistent with a lot of that, but actually what I'm going to be going over now is more mainstream economics as opposed to Austrian economics. And in fact, I will, on the show notes page for this, which is, again, Laura Murphy Show, episode 36, I'll post one or perhaps more, if I can find them, articles from Murray Rothbard on this type of stuff, because he actually sometimes cross swords with more mainstream, or let's say supply side economists, when they talked about tax reform. And Rothbard thought sometimes they conceded too much to the government. To give one example, it's standard in this kind of analysis to insist on what's called revenue neutrality. So the idea is, and I get where they're coming from, an economist will say, okay, holding the total amount of revenue that the government raises constant, I propose that we raise that revenue with a different tax structure. Instead of taxing corporate income at this amount and personal income at 6 different brackets and blah, 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 let's get rid of all that and just have a national sales tax at a single flat rate of such and such. And then we'll raise the same amount of revenue and there'll be a lot more job creation and economic growth and more savings rate will go up and da-da-da-da. So the government's fine. They're getting the same number of dollars. And yet look at all the benefits that will flow from my tax reform plan. So that's standard in this genre, let's say, that kind of analysis. And so one thing that Murray Rothbard would object to is to say, why are you just conceding that the government deserves all this revenue? If we're going to have tax reform, let's cut the amount of revenue the government gets. Stick it to the man. Ha ha. Right. So I will, because I want the listeners of the Laura Murphy Show to understand that element of it. And so I will try to find one or more good Rothbard articles in that vein. But I just want you to know the stuff you're going to hear from me for the rest of this episode is fairly standard. And partly why I'm going through this, it's not so much, or it's not merely, that I want you, the listeners of the Laura Murphy Show, to know what do I think about tax reform and what do I think you need to know about this GOP plan. But it's also, I want to equip you so that when you go out and read other blog posts on this stuff from other economists, or you listen to other people talking about it on CNBC or what have you, I want you to understand the terminology they're using, and I want to give you more of the framework, because I've seen other economists, when they write on their blogs, even if they're intended for the general public, when they write stuff, a lot of times they use terminology and they assume that the listener or the reader has a lot of this background, which you wouldn't necessarily have, especially if you haven't studied economics formally. So since that's part of my goal here, it only makes sense that I'm going to use the language and the framework that mainstream economists use on this stuff. Okay, so last caveat, I don't claim that this is going to be comprehensive. It's not as if I were teaching this at the college level, that this would be a standalone lecture and this would have everything you'd need. But certainly the things I'm going to hit are commonplace in this kind of a discussion. So first of all, I should say that when economists are talking about the problems of different types of tax codes, what they have in mind is not really an issue of, oh, the public deserves their money. You know, the private sector, those people earn the money, and the government's a bunch of parasites, looting thieves who take the money, and that's not right. All right, so that's not the perspective they're coming from. Even if they thought that personally, which, you know, many free market economists in particular do probably have that kind of attitude, still, that's not scientific, right? So economics tries to be value-free in the sense that if we're going to say something definitive, we want to be clear as to, are we smuggling in our personal value judgments here, or are we just making a neutral claim about the way the world works? So the criterion that mainstream economics uses is efficiency. And there's different types of it. I don't want to get bogged down too much in the details here, but the idea is that if a mainstream economist says that a certain kind of tax code is poorly designed, or, you know, is not an ideal type of tax, they don't just mean, hey, that's not fair that, you know, some people are paying a lot. What they mean is for the government to raise a dollar in revenue, it's in a very real sense costing the taxpayers more than a dollar in forfeited economic opportunity. And so there's what's called deadweight loss. That's another term. So there's a deadweight loss from the tax code. So again, meaning that the government is raising revenue that it's then going to spend on bridges or bombs or transfer payments, whatever. It's raising revenue in such a way that it's making the taxpayers poorer to a greater degree than the government is gaining from the tax receipts. Okay, so to the extent that that happens, it's inefficient. So another way of putting it is the gains to the IRS are lower than the losses to the taxpayer. So let me elaborate on that a little bit, because it's, you know, to some people that might sound impossible. And I don't mean merely what you might be thinking. You might say, oh, I get it, because there's like employees at the IRS or just more generally in the government. And so if they raise $1 billion in tax receipts, well, they got to pay the salaries of the bureaucrats and the people who man the IRS systems, and just even to keep the website up and running at irs.gov and all that kind of stuff. And of course they need the enforcement officers to keep people sending in that money. And so is that what you mean, Bob? Well, yeah, that's included, but strictly speaking, that's not really even what economists usually have in mind when they say that the tax code is inefficient and it has deadweight losses. That's often not the kind of stuff they have in mind. I mean, so yeah, that is included if you push them on it, but that's not usually what they mean. So let me just walk you through the concept here in case this is new to you. So imagine that the government levies a $1 per box tax on Cheerios. And so what would be the effects of that? And let's say it's in a certain town, all right, and that every year there's 1 million boxes of Cheerios that are sold in this jurisdiction. So what does that do? That means the government raises $1 million in receipts, tax receipts from this tax. All right, so one way of looking at the impact is just to look at the, you know, the transfer. But the way economists would look at that is they'd say, oh, you know what? That's actually inefficient. It would make more sense if you're going to do that. It would be better to levy a smaller tax on boxes of cereal, period, not just on Cheerios. So if when they did that to raise $1 million, maybe it ended up being that, oh, they just need to put a whatever, a nickel per box tax on all kinds of breakfast cereals. And then that ends up raising $1 million, right? Because I guess there's 20 million total boxes of cereal that are sold in this particular jurisdiction if there's a nickel tax added to it. Whereas to raise $1 million, just putting a tax on Cheerios, they would need to levy a dollar per box tax. So, of course, I'm making those numbers up, but the pattern is the same, that if you're taxing a broader base, namely if you're taxing all cereal boxes to raise a given amount of revenue, the rate would need to be much lower than if you were just concentrating the tax totally on one particular brand, for example, Cheerios. Okay, so either way, $1 million of new tax revenue is raised, but most economists, I would say the overwhelming majority, would say, unless you have some particular reason to want to discourage people from eating Cheerios, like you find out it's got some kind of poison in it or something, or I don't know what. But absent that kind of a rationale, if this is really just a revenue raising mechanism, clearly putting the nickel tax on all the cereal and raising $1 million that way makes a lot more sense than putting a dollar per box tax just on Cheerios and raising $1 million that way. So notice, it's not the issue of taking money from the taxpayers and transferring it to the government and saying, oh, this is $1 million tax. They're both $1 million taxes. And yet, as I say, the majority of economists would say clearly the nickel per box tax on all the cereal is far more efficient. So the idea is that would raise the desired amount of revenue, in this case, $1 million, with much less damage or much less deadweight loss imposed on the economy than the dollar per box tax levied on Cheerios. And the reason is that when you put a dollar per box tax on the Cheerios, that makes Cheerios artificially more expensive than the other cereal and than other goods in general. And so it's not, so what ends up happening is it distorts people's behavior. So here in the, with this podcast and the time constraints, I'm not going to go into a whole defense of the market process and why is it that prices perform a useful social function. But if you at least give me that as the background, and you can generally agree that yes, prices do something in a free society, they serve a purpose, and it matters whether the price on cereal is $2 versus $3, that really means something and it helps people coordinate their activities. So if you grant me all that and you agree that the prices help us coordinate with each other and they help steer scarce resources into their most important ends, well, then the government coming along and artificially saying, no, Cheerios, instead of costing whatever, $2 a box, actually now they're going to cost $3 a box because we're levying this dollar per box tax on them. That distorts things, right? That makes consumers buy fewer boxes of Cheerios than they otherwise would have, and they buy more units of other things. So probably cereal, but also all kinds of other stuff, right? Because ultimately everything competes for your dollar. So that is where the deadweight loss comes in. It's that it causes consumers to change their behavior such that the distribution and use of resources ends up being less efficient than it was originally. So if you think that the market economy has a tendency to channel resources to where they're supposed to go and in the proper quantities, and you realize how the price system helps equilibrate all that and make it happen, then clearly the government coming in and making some of the prices a lot different from what they otherwise would have been, that's going to change things. And if the original allocation was efficient, then changing it is going to make it farther from efficiency. Okay, so in that respect, then, I hope you can see how it would make sense and it's intuitive that, oh, okay, to raise the revenue the government wants, it's a lot less disruptive. It distorts things less if you just put a nickel tax on all the cereal rather than putting a dollar tax just on the Cheerios. Okay? So that's an idea there. And that's what leads to a principle of tax policy that says, as a general rule, to raise a given amount of revenue, you want to apply the tax on as broad a base as possible with as low a rate as possible. And, you know, and those two things, of course, go hand in hand. That the broader the base is, the more things that get hit with the tax, the better, because that allows you to lower the rate, and also it reduces the distortion between the taxed and the untaxed sectors. Okay, so again, this is all assuming that you're holding constant the amount of revenue we're raising. All right, so you know, clearly, it would be better to put just a dollar tax on Cheerios as opposed to $50 tax on all the different cereals, right? Because there you're changing how much revenue you're raising. But to raise a given target amount of revenue, again, is a general principle. Economists are going to say have the broadest possible base, the things to which the tax applies, and that will allow you to lower the actual rate that you're applying as much as possible. Because there's another result that's standard in the literature that says the distortion caused by a tax, if it's expressed as a percentage, if the tax rate is expressed like as a percentage, that the distortion caused is proportional to the square of the tax rate. All right, so if you originally are taxing something at 10% and then you double the tax rate to 20%, that, you know, that's going to increase the damage by a factor of four, not just a doubling of the damage. Okay, and so that kind of shows you how you really want to keep that rate as low as possible. And again, the way you do that is by spreading it out over as much stuff to minimize the distortion. Another way for me just to quickly motivate this idea to get you to see the problem with taxes is not merely how much money is the government taking out of our pockets, that's certainly involved. But more fundamentally, the problem is that it changes behavior. So imagine if the government, instead of levying the $1 tax on the Cheerios, which, as we said, suppose raises $1 million because there's a million boxes of Cheerios that end up getting sold if there's a dollar per box tax. What if now the legislators get really greedy and they say, you know what, we need a lot more money. Let's go ahead and levy a $10 per box surtax on just Cheerios. And they go ahead and pass that thinking they're going to get $10 million now. Well, what happens? Now, instead of there just being a dollar tax, there's a $10 tax per box. What happens is Cheerios disappears from the store shelves, right? Nobody actually officially buys Cheerios by going to the store, walking to the register, and paying whatever it is, $14 or whatever the price is going to be in the new equilibrium with the $10 tax slapped on it. Nobody's going to do that. Some people might still be eating Cheerios, but they're getting it from the black market, right? With a tax that high, people in neighboring jurisdictions where they didn't have that tax, they would be selling Cheerios to smugglers who would then come in, or people would, you know, go in their minivans and drive across state lines to wherever they would be outside the jurisdiction of this crazy $10 tax, and they would load up with a 3-month supply or whatever and come back and then maybe sell it to their friends or something under the table. But clearly, especially if we assume this jurisdiction's pretty small, like it's just a city or something that's levying this crazy tax, the city government that levies it is not going to see any revenue from it. You know, it's possible they literally get $0 in receipts once this new tax kicks in, because official sales of Cheerios now in that jurisdiction literally dropped to zero. Okay, so in that case, though, would it be correct to say, oh, well, actually, this tax now is raising $0 in revenue, so it's harmless, right? You would think that if the way you were gauging the severity or the damage of a tax was by how many dollars does it bring in, you know, and people talk about that a lot. You know, they'll say, oh, my gosh, Obama, you know, this particular measure is going to be a $128 billion tax hike over the next 10 years. So that's standard where they say, oh, Ronald Reagan gave a huge tax cut, and they'll quantify it in terms of dollar amounts. But what I'm pointing out is actually that's really not the full story by any stretch, and that when economists assess the impact of a tax and how good or bad is it in terms of economic efficiency, the total amount of dollars it brings in by itself really isn't that big a deal, or at least that's not the whole story. Because again, just to make sure you're not losing the point here, in this absurd scenario where the government originally had a $1 per box tax on Cheerios and was raising $1 million, then jacks it up to $10 per box, the official amount of revenue before and after would have been $1 million, and then after the change would have gone to zero. But it would be wrong to say, oh yeah, originally that tax was kind of onerous, but now it's completely harmless. No, the people are still greatly inconvenienced. They're being forced to a combination of things such as buying other types of cereal instead of Cheerios because the other types don't get hit with that tax. Or if they really want Cheerios, now they're doing stuff like having to drive an hour outside the jurisdiction and loading up. And so then, you know, a bigger portion of their pantry now gets filled up with Cheerios for 3 months worth. And, you know, they have to spend more money on gasoline and things because they have to drive now to the Sam's Club. It's in the other city and so on. Right. So there's lots of ways that these households are made worse off because of this tax, even if they literally never pay any of it, because they've had to alter their behavior in light of the new tax. Okay, so a perhaps silly example, but just trying to get you to see this is the kind of thing economists have in mind when they assess the impact of a tax and why they conclude other things equal. If we're really just trying to raise revenue here in the way that disrupts the economy as little as possible, then again, what you want to do is have the tax apply to as broad a base as possible with as low a rate as possible. Okay, so now if that's true, what does that mean? Well, you don't want things like if we're talking about an income tax, for example. You don't want tax credits. You don't want deductions, and you don't want different tax brackets. What you would want from the perspective of economic efficiency and to not distort behavior is you would want one flat rate applied to every, you know, your first dollar of income all the way up to your top dollar of income applied to all sorts of activity, right? That you would not, for example, say, oh, if you are paying money, paying interest on a home mortgage, well, then you can deduct that from your income tax. Or if you're going to donate money to a church, well, then you can deduct that. Or if you're going to install solar panels on your roof, well, then, yeah, we'll give you a tax credit for that. Or you're going to have another kid, oh, yeah, we'll give you a tax credit. Right? You wouldn't have all that stuff. Because if we're, again, for the purposes of the analysis, taking it as given how much revenue the government has to raise from the tax cut, from this income tax, the more carve outs you put in there, you're not lowering the total amount of dollars that households are paying to the IRS. All you're doing is jacking up the rate. All right. So if the government says, okay, everybody gets a standard $10,000 deduction, well, if you're, again, assuming the government needs to raise a certain amount of revenue, they're still going to get it somehow. It's just now the rate, the percentage rate that they apply to your income above the deduction has to be higher. And so on the margin, that distorts people's behavior more. It means, you know, instead of, I'm just making up numbers here, but if it works out that, oh, we would have to tax everybody's income at 20% if there were no deductions, but if we give everybody a standard deduction of $10,000, now to raise the same amount of revenue, we need to tax everybody's income, of course, above that standard deduction by 30%. Again, I'm just totally making those numbers up. I don't know if that's anywhere even close to being accurate. Then it raises the same amount of revenue by assumption, but now people on the margin, if they go and earn an extra $1,000, they only get to keep 700 of it instead of being able to keep 800 of it. And that's the difference between the 20% and the 30% tax rate. Okay, and so on the margin, it penalizes extra work effort more to have that higher tax rate. And so it's going to change behavior. You're going to get people working less, both in terms of how much do they work during the year, right? So if you're an entrepreneur in particular, and you have a lot of flexibility in how many projects you take on, or if you're going to, you know, considering taking a second job, you're going to be less likely to do that. And also for people when they're deciding when to retire, other things equal, they're going to retire earlier if they're getting hit with a 30% marginal tax rate instead of a 20% one. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff that mainstream economists have in mind when they want to, quote, simplify the tax code. So again, let me just say here that Austrian economists and libertarians don't necessarily go along with that. So mainstream economists might champion a tax reform that lowers the marginal rates, but gets rid of deductions and, quote, loopholes and stuff like that, closed loopholes. Somebody like Murray Rothbard would say, no, I love loopholes. That's, you know, our little areas where the government's taking its mitts off of us and giving us some breathing room. And so Rothbard's very suspicious about plans to, quote, close loopholes. So, again, here I'm not getting into the political economy of it or the morality of it, because there is a certain sense in which that kind of logic makes it sound like the government owns all of your income and then just grants you, out of the goodness of their heart, the ability to keep some of it. I get all that. I'm just telling you so you understand the perspective of these mainstream economists and where they're coming from and why, for example, they don't like the deduction on home mortgage interest. They think that that distorts the housing sector. It makes it more attractive to buy a house rather than to rent. And so, you know, they say, why would politicians be doing it? Why do we want them to artificially encourage people to buy housing and also to load up on debt, right? I mean, I'm sure the listeners of this podcast, more than other groups, are very familiar with that idea, right? Where somebody might be thinking, oh, maybe I'll just take out a 15-year mortgage. And someone will say, well, no, that's stupid. That's going to hurt your tax bill. Why don't you go ahead and take out a 30-year mortgage? And that way, you know, you can maximize the deduction. And so you're, you know, lowering your tax bill by loading up on more debt. So you get the logic of that and how it makes sense given what the tax code is. Maybe you want to do that, maybe you don't. But the point is, as economists talking about the ideal tax code, it seems kind of weird that why would we put in this artificial provision that just causes millions of Americans to load up on more debt than they otherwise would have? That seems kind of a weird thing. Why would we want to encourage them to do that? And yet that's what this home mortgage deduction does. So, and the same thing, another one that's really in the news right now with healthcare reform is the so-called Cadillac tax, or tax on Cadillac insurance plans. All right, so the Affordable Care Act had a measure in it that was going to slap a 40% surtax on employers if they paid premiums higher than a certain amount for their employees' health insurance. So the rationale for that was it was really just counteracting, negating right now what's in the tax code, which says if an employer pays premiums for an employee's health insurance plan, then that is not counted as taxable income to the employee. So that's a huge tax incentive to cause employers to not just give you a big pile of money in your compensation, but instead to structure it so that some of your compensation comes in the form of the employer paying for your health insurance premiums on your behalf. Because that's, the employer still gets to write it off as a business expense, but you, the employee, don't have to declare it as taxable income. So you're effectively paying for your health care, or health insurance, I should say, with pre-tax dollars that way. So a lot of economists would say that's inefficient. You want to, you know, geez, you want to know why our health costs rising so rapidly? Part of the issue is because of the tax code. It's causing, you know, it's giving this huge incentive for ultimately a lot of healthcare spending to work not through the individual who's going to be real cost conscious and shop around, but through these giant third party networks where, you know, you're just a cog in the machine and you have no bargaining power. And you're just going to wherever doctors in network and you're not really caring about how much the procedure costs. Oh, I'm supposed to get an MRI. Okay. Doesn't bother me. I'm not paying for it. So a lot of economists think that's one of the screwy features of our current healthcare, health insurance network in the United States. Okay. So, but in terms of the current topic here of tax reform, that's just another example of how the tax code right now has features that don't apply the same rate to everything. Instead, there's big carve-outs where, yeah, they've got these marginal rates that apply, but you can deduct and get credits here, there, and everywhere, and where the government's having the default position be this really onerous tax rate, and then it's given all kinds of carve-outs all over the place to try to spare you from the full brunt of it. And so it's just controlling your behavior. And so, again, economists are saying rather than do that, you could have a much simpler tax structure that raises the same amount of revenue, and yet it just has one low rate that applies to all income, period, with no deductions, tax credits, and so on. Okay, so that's where the logic of having a flat tax comes in. And also, again, you might say, well, wait a minute, you talked about deductions and things, but what about the brackets? So the logic for having just one bracket also is similar, that ultimately where people make decisions is on the margin. And so it's how much of that last dollar that's being taxed, that's where your marginal decision making comes in. And so if you have what's called a progressive tax code, where I'm making these numbers up, income up to $20,000 get taxed at 5%. Income from $20,000 to $30,000 gets taxed at 15%. Income up to $100,000 gets taxed at 35%, and income up to $1 million gets taxed at 50%. Or if you have a structure like that, which is called a progressive income tax, that might strike people as being fair, but it's very inefficient because, again, it, especially for the high income earners, the most productive people in society, they're getting taxed on the margin at that highest top rate. And so that's really discouraging their behavior. And they're engaging in all kinds of inefficient activities to minimize their tax bill. So, for example, instead of them going out and investing in the assets that, you know, they think are going to give them the highest return, instead they might go buy tax-free municipal bonds because, oh, well, I'm not getting hit with that tax, right? And so that's distorting behavior. As I said before, they're not going to work as much. They're going to retire earlier than they otherwise would have, so on and so forth. So you want to bring that top rate down as much as possible. So for a given amount of revenue the government's going to raise, the way you minimize the top rate is to have the same rate for all levels of income, right? Because if you have lower rates for lower brackets, then that means you got to have higher rates for the higher brackets in order to raise the same amount of revenue. Okay, another element in all this is, besides the distortions from the rates itself, you also had this issue of the more complex the tax code gets, the harder it is to comply with it. So here I am now including stuff like the personnel of the government that's necessary to enforce the thing, but it's much more than that. That really, when you talk about the compliance costs of the tax code, it has to do with, you know, you collecting receipts all year. You know, so in other words, if there are all kinds of deductions and ways you can claim tax credits and so on, well, then you got to keep track of all that stuff. You don't just know, oh, what's my total income? You got to say, oh, gee, I spent all this money on education, and maybe, you know, there's deductions I can claim for that. So I got to go ahead and itemize all of my expenses. And, oh, wait a minute, do I have an HSA, or do I have this kind of stuff? So I got to keep track of all my medical expenses during the year to see what happened there. So the point is that, again, is unnecessary, that that's a bunch of effort. Yeah, it's individually rational, given that that's what the tax code is, that it's worth it to you to save all your receipts and engage in all that hassle, pay more to your CPA or whatever, because it takes that person more work to prepare your tax return, the more complex the tax code gets. So it makes sense to do that individually, given that that's how the tax code is. But the idea is, if we just had a real simple tax code, you know, a straight flat tax, everybody pays 13% of their income, period, you fill it out on a postcard, and, you know, tax time would not be the nightmare that it is. I mean, you'd still end up giving money to the government, so that wouldn't be fun, writing them a check, or at least just seeing how much they withheld from you. But the point is, you would not have to keep track of all these receipts. Or for large companies, if we're talking about the corporate income tax and so on, you know, right now they have huge departments with all kinds of employees whose sole purpose is to make sure the corporation is compliant when it files its taxes. So the simpler you make the tax code, the fewer resources the society has to expend just on having all the tax-paying units comply with the tax code. So that's clearly a deadweight loss from that perspective, that you could free up, you know, millions of labor hours per year where those smart, productive people could go do something else, right? It doesn't make society richer just to have all these smart people figuring out how to minimize your taxes and file taxes and so on. Okay, so that's another element in all of this. Now, another component is you'll see a lot of mainstream economists talking about the benefits of having a consumption tax as opposed to an income tax. So let me just briefly explain where they're coming from. And this is why you'll see a lot of economists favoring either a sales tax or just a straight up consumption tax, or what's called a VAT, a value added tax. And so in the context of this GOP reform, it's not exactly a VAT. It's sort of like a VAT with a subsidy for hiring domestic workers and land factors. All right. So don't worry. If you don't know what that means, don't worry about it. But there's nothing else that's exactly like it. And so I've seen some economists, notably Paul Krugman, trying to wrap his head around the thing. And he said, well, it's kind of like a VAT, but then on top of it, businesses can deduct wage payments. And if they, you know, make rental payments to resource owners domestically, they can deduct that too. Whereas with a VAT, you can't. And so he's that's the way he analyzes it. But the point being, the distinction between taxing consumption as opposed to taxing income. So most economists would say of those two things in terms of efficiency, it makes more sense to tax consumption rather than income. Again, holding the total amount of revenue constant. So why do they say that? Well, the issue is when you're taxing income, that has an extra distortion in it. Whereas if you're taxing consumption, that only has one main distortion. All right. So when it comes to just taxing consumption, okay, so you as a consumer, you're going to go, let's say there's a 10% consumption tax. You're going to go buy a car that costs $10,000 or $20,000. You pay $2,000 in tax. You buy groceries that cost $100. You pay $10 in tax. Okay, so if you had just a single, you know, all types of consumption, you pay a flat percentage tax on that. The distortion there is going to be on your work effort. Right. So if you did have a consumption tax, especially the higher that rate gets, that reduces the appeal of working, because the whole point of working, yes, you earn income, but ultimately that income is spent on consumption. Right. Even if you're going to spend it in the future, even if you're going to build up assets and then bequeath them to your heirs, well, ultimately, why do they want to get an inheritance from you? It's because they can spend it on consumption. You might say, well, no, what if they're going to pass it on to their heirs? Okay, but the point of having wealth, financial assets, is ultimately that you can consume some of it, right? So, yeah, if you want to be smart and pass it on to somebody so they can have that too, but ultimately the reason you feel more secure having wealth is because, you know, if you needed to, you could spend it on consumption. That's the point. So the idea is ultimately the reason you're working, generating income, building up wealth is for consumption, either yourself or for people you bequeath it to. And so knowing that there's now that tax in place, that reduces the value to you of being able to consume, right? That if you have $1,000 that you want to spend on consumption, well, now you're only really getting $900 of enjoyment out of it, and the other 100's going to the government if it's a 10% consumption tax. So it's really like you're only getting after tax $900 worth of consumption. So before, if you were going to do a certain amount of work in order to get $1,000 in income and then you were going to spend it on consumption, now with that tax in place, you know, you're only getting $900 really worth of consumption when all is said and done. So on the margin, working to you is less attractive than it was before. So you're going to work less than you did before. another way of looking at it is, of all the possible bundles of consumption you could enjoy, they include a certain amount of leisure, right? So you could say, gee, I could get a really nice car and have a certain amount of leisure, or I could get a cheaper car and have more leisure because I'm not working as much. Or I could, you know, live in a nice apartment and have a little bit of leisure, or I could live in a really modest apartment and have more leisure, right? So the consumption tax, if you want to think of it this way, artificially penalizes consumption that you buy in the marketplace with money. Or another way of looking at it is, it artificially privileges the consumption you get on your own that you don't have to earn money to buy, right? So if you just engage in leisure, you're not getting taxed on that, even though you could say I'm consuming leisure. Okay, so it does distort things. So, but make no mistake, a consumption tax does distort economic activity. Namely, it causes people to work less than they otherwise would. Okay, but a consumption tax, again, raising the same amount of revenue over time, is less distortionary than an income tax, because an income tax also distorts the labor leisure decision. Hang on, let me go back. A consumption tax also distorts any type of using productive factors to earn income. It's not just labor leisure, but also if you own virgin forest land, let's say, all right, so you own this gorgeous forest and Bambi's prancing around in there, and you just go out in your land and there's a stream and it's just gorgeous out there, and you're considering selling that thing to some commercial developer who's going to come in and bulldoze everything and put up a shopping center. Well, a consumption tax also makes you less likely to do that, right? Because the benefit to you of doing that, you know, the trade-off is I could just leave this nature in its raw, pristine form and just enjoy it. Or I can sell that to the developer who's going to give me a pile of money, and then I'll go out and, you know, go on vacations and buy a bunch of filet mignon and buy Corvettes or whatever with it. Go live in a mansion somewhere. So all those other ways of enjoyment, I'm going to get hit with the consumption tax. Whereas if I'm just enjoying my virgin land, then it's not that, you know, year after year I'm paying a consumption tax on that, even though I'm enjoying the flow of services of, you know, natural beauty. It's not like I'm paying anybody money for that. So in terms of official transactions, that's not showing up anywhere, and the government's not earning consumption tax receipts from that. Okay, so again, it's not just the labor leisure decision. It's any way of factor owners, land, labor, or even capital goods, selling their productive services to raise money. A consumption tax distorts that decision on the margin. Now, back to what I was saying before, an income tax, though, is worse, because not only does the income tax distort that decision, the decision of how much of my productive factors, including labor, do I want to sell for money, but it also distorts the consumption today versus saving today decision. So it distorts the consumption now versus consumption later trade-off. So given that you've earned an income, you don't have to spend it today. You could save it and spend it down the road. And what's the benefit of that? Well, you earn interest. And so a consumption tax, as long as the rate stays the same across time periods, doesn't distort that particular decision. So once you earn $1,000 in income, and now you're deciding, do I want to spend it on $1,000 of consumption today, or do I want to save it and, you know, have $1,000 or $1,010 next year, if there's a 1% interest rate, and then spend it then, if there's just a flat consumption tax, that doesn't, you know, that affects how much total income I'm going to earn, how much I'm going to work, or how much of my natural resources I'm going to sell off. But it doesn't distort, do I want to then, whatever income I do get, do I want to consume it today, or do I want to save it, defer it, and consume it down the road? The consumption tax doesn't distort that decision, because I just still get hit at the time of consuming. I get hit with that flat rate. But an income tax does distort it, because the income tax says if you earn $1,000 today, then you pay the income tax, whatever, if it's 10%, then you pay $100 today. But if I wait and earn interest, well, now interest is a form of income. And so I pay more income tax if I wait. Okay. And so the idea is that the income I'm earning from interest is not fully being allowed to communicate to me the social benefits of deferring consumption, if you want to think of it that way, right? So market prices, again, communicate information, and the interest rate, in a sense, is telling you this is the trade-off in terms of resources and people's time preference schedules, blah, blah, blah. If you're willing to basically, you know, sell consumption today and buy consumption next year, the interest rate is telling you the exchange rate between those two things. If that's one way to think about it. And if there's now an income tax that includes interest income, you are only getting some of that. You're not feeling the full benefit. And so you're artificially consuming more today than you should optimally. If you're doing, you know, if you're allocating your resources properly. So it's kind of like the, you know, the tax on Cheerios makes Cheerios artificially more expensive and causes people to buy fewer boxes of Cheerios and more boxes of Lucky Charms. It's not that we as economists say, oh no, Cheerios is really better than Lucky Charms. That's not what we're saying, obviously. What we're saying is market prices should be able to communicate that information, let consumers make their own choices armed with that those correct prices that properly reflect the actual underlying scarcity. And the government comes along and places an arbitrary tax on Cheerios that distorts things. So here, analogously, with an income tax, the government is artificially making future consumption more expensive than it really is. And it's making present consumption artificially cheaper than it really is. And so it distorts that intertemporal decision. So that's, again, to summarize, the consumption tax is distortionary. It makes you sell fewer of your productive resources, including your labor hours, for money. But at least once you do earn your income, the consumption tax doesn't then on top of that screw up your decision on how to spend that income over time. Whereas the income tax is a double whammy. It screws up the decision about turning your productive factors into income in the first place. And then how you allocate it over time is also screwed up because income deferred actually generates more income through interest or dividends or whatever, capital gains. And so the income tax typically hits those things as well as forms of income, which they are, and thus artificially penalizes saving. So it's not that we as economists are saying, oh, saving is good, people should save more. No, it's like with the Cheerios thing. We're saying people should save based on the actual signals that market prices are giving them, based on their own time preferences and based on everybody else's time preferences and what entrepreneurs think in terms of the actual trade-offs of investments now versus things paying off down the road, and let people go ahead and allocate their spending decisions over time based on those proper signals. And an income tax artificially penalizes consumption that you want to engage in down the road. Okay, well, at this point, why don't I wrap up? So again, I just hit some of the major themes talking about the senses in which economists think that tax reform can promote efficiency. In general, they want to lower tax rates, apply it to as big a base as possible, have a single flat tax if possible. And then, you know, given that you're going to have one rate taxing things, you say, okay, rate on what? Taxing income? And actually, most economists would say, well, no, if all you really care about is efficiency, taxing consumption makes a lot more sense than taxing income because, again, it only distorts economic activity along one dimension, namely turning productive factors into money, whereas an income tax distorts decisions across two dimensions, turning productive factors into money, and then how do you allocate spending over time. So that concludes this episode 36 of the Laura Murphy Show. And after that little primer now on tax reform from a mainstream economics perspective, I'll invite you to tune back in for episode 37. We'll have Carlos back and we'll be talking about the GOP tax plan, some of the real world problems that it's going to have, and more generally what happens in the real world when economists take their ivory tower pointy head theories and try to put them into practice. A lot of times things don't always turn out the way they might have thought. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not here and engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.